that all the information for the exam is on the webpage. That if you can't make the surf symposium tomorrow, although I hope you will, if you need to get extra credit some other way, read the instructions. You have to email me before the surf symposium. That the exam will cover part of today, but not all of it. Exam one will cover topics 1 through 3, but not 4 and 5. And the last year's exam will be posted tomorrow. And if there are any other issues about the exam, please look at the exam one info page. Be sure there isn't anything that you need to know, and email me if there is. Now, I want to pick up today by talking some more about receptor-mediated endocytosis. Last time when we talked about it, we explained how you get something inside the cell, and now we want to pick up from there. But first, let's look at 5C again. If you don't have one, there's some up here. And we want to look at the beginning stages in receptor-mediated endocytosis. That you have receptors on the surface of the cell, and you have the protein clathrin, which will help form a vesicle. And when the receptor binds the appropriate ligand, then the receptor moves into the area where the clathrin is. The point of clathrin is to help the membrane bend and form a vesicle. Some sort of coat protein is required on the outside of any membrane in order for it to invaginate on the curving side. Now, this region, which has indented a little bit like a dimple on the surface of the cell, this is called a coated pit. Because if you look in the electron microscope, you see the curve and then you see some stuff on the other side of the membrane. And the coated pit continues to invaginate, and then it pinches off so that we have a coated vesicle. Now, which is separate from the plasma membrane. And whatever was on the outside of the cell, the extracellular domain, is now inside the lumen of the vesicle. Now, once we get this far and we form the complete vesicle, the clathrin has done its job. And it can now come off. This is energy requiring, so it's actually kicked off. And the clathrin can then recycle to another region of the membrane, form another coated pit, and do it again. It's at this point that what happens depends on the ligand. We said last time that some of the material that was internalized some of it is going to be inside this vesicle, which will go back and fuse with the plasma membrane and return the material to the plasma membrane. But some of the material is going to stay inside the cell. Now, what we want to do is pick up how does the cell sort out what goes back to the surface, what stays inside. And that's done in the next stage, which is called a sorting vesicle or an endosome. In the endosome, there's a relatively low pH, not as low as in a lysosome, but lower than the cytoplasm. And in those conditions, many things that are weakly bound separate from each other. And so in this acidic environment, some of the material separates, and some of it goes to one part of the endosome, and that part of the endosome will pinch off and form a vesicle, and that vesicle will return to the plasma membrane. Another area of the vesicle will pinch off, and that will contain material, say, that's going to go to a lysosome, and that stuff will be degraded. Different vesicles pinch off from different regions of the endosome and go to different targets. Now, we're discussing it as if it's one thing. It may happen gradually. Now, how do you get a low pH in here? It means you have to put some protons in. And the way that's done is with a proton pump in the membrane. And this is primary active transport, so it's driven by ATP hydrolysis. Now, what happens to something inside this endosome or sorting vesicle varies depending on what the receptor and what the ligand is. So we're going to talk about a couple of different examples. The first one we're going to talk about is LDL. What happens with LDL is very much the way it is written in your handout, that the receptor and its ligand separate. And they go to separate regions of the endosome, so that in fact the ligand ends up going to a vesicle which goes to the lysosome and is degraded, and the receptor goes to a vesicle which is recycled. Now let's see what LDL is and why this system makes sense. LDL stands for low density lipoprotein. Meaning it contains both lipid and protein, but low density means that it's mostly lipid. This contains cholesterol. Cholesterol is needed by cells in order to make membranes. And it's also used in some cells to start the synthesis of steroid hormones. Now, cells can make their own cholesterol, but there's a lot of cholesterol in what you eat, and that goes into the blood and is picked up by the cells. But cholesterol is a lipophilic molecule, and it can't just float through the blood all by itself. So what happens is you have a kind of ball stuffed with cholesterol, actually cholesterol esters. And it's surrounded by a single layer of amphipathic lipid. So there's like a skin on the outside. Now remember, this is a cross-section. So this means that the lipid, the amphipathic lipid, goes all the way around. Now these amphipathic lipids consist of plain cholesterol, some of it, and the usual membrane lipids, phospholipids. Now this would be just lipid, but the thing is a lipoprotein. So there's one molecule of protein as part of it, and that's called the carrier protein. So this is how the cholesterol goes from your liver through the blood to the target cells. Now I want to make this part pink because it's actually the carrier protein that binds to the receptor. The receptor, which is what we have right here, is called the LDL receptor. And it actually sticks to the carrier protein part of the LDL particle. Notice this isn't just lipid or just protein. It's not a molecule. It's a particle, a conglomerate of molecules. So if I wanted to make this look more like LDL, it would look more like this. Now, so I should put the rest here too. When the LDL and its receptor together get to the endosome, the two separate. The receptor goes to one part, the LDL goes to another. The receptor is in a part that pinches off and now goes back and fuses with the plasma membrane, returning the receptor to the surface. It takes a molecule of LDL receptor about 20 minutes to do a round trip. That is, to pick up LDL, take it to the endosome, dump it, and go back again. Now, what happens to the LDL? Cholesterol esters have to be broken down to cholesterol before they can be metabolized. And this protein, the carrier protein, has basically done its job. So the whole LDL combination is degraded. And it does that by joining a lysosome. You remember, a lysosome has hydrolytic enzymes which work at very low pH. This has an even lower pH than an endosome. And the low pH activates the hydrolytic enzymes, so they break the cholesterol esters down in cholesterol and esters. They break the ester part, and they break the fatty acids, and they break the protein molecule down into amino acids. And all these monomers can then be used again for macromolecular synthesis. Now, there's two cases here where something joins or becomes something else. Here we have an uncoated vesicle. And the next step is an endosome. Here we have a vesicle from the endosome, and the next step is a lysosome. Now, it's not quite clear how one turns into the next. One possibility is that this vesicle turns into an endosome, that it becomes acidified and becomes a sorting vesicle. Another possibility is that it joins a pre-existing endosome and the contents fuse. It's not quite clear which it is. Similarly, when this material to be degraded, how does it get to a lysosome? It may join a pre-existing lysosome. Alternatively, it may join with vesicles of newly made hydrolytic enzymes, get it together, and get acidified. Either way, the material from the LDL ends up in a lysosome where the enzymes degrade it, and the receptor is recycled back up to the surface. Now that, there's only one other thing I wanted to mention about LDL. Last semester, we talked about the disease hypercholesterolemia. And that's actually caused by low levels of the LDL receptor. This is a dominant condition, and people who have it have half the normal amount of LDL receptor. So if you have only half the amount of receptor, you can only trap half the amount of LDL, and you leave too much cholesterol in the blood. And this is actually quite a common condition. About one person in 30 has it. And what you have to do is control your intake and synthesis of cholesterol. Now, I want to talk about another example. But before I do, let me ask if there are any questions about this one. Okay, so let's look then how a cell picks up a different macromolecule or particle. And this time, the second one we want to talk about is EGF. Now, GF stands for growth factor. And the E stands for epidermal. There are many, many different growth factors in the body. And they have, this particular one is one of the ones that was discovered first and is known fairly well. It's made by one kind of cell. All growth factors are. They're made by one kind of cell, and they stimulate either other cells or cells of the same kind to grow. And exactly how they do that is something we'll talk about later. But the important point here is that this molecule is a signal, and the receptor cell gets the kick, go ahead, grow. So if we draw our cell with a receptor, When the EGF comes along, and it binds to the receptor, this changes the conformation of the intracellular part of the receptor. And this intracellular change is what triggers off the events inside the cell to grow, and exactly how we'll come back to. Now, once this has happened, what do we want to do? This is a signal, it's like the alarm clock, and it goes off. You want to turn it off. And so the cell is going to destroy the signal. It's going to degrade the EGF. But it's going to go further than that. When you turn your alarm clock off, not only do you want it to stop, but you don't want it to go off again for 24 hours. And so what you do here is quite similar. Once the cell starts to grow, it doesn't want to receive the signal to grow for quite some time. So it not only degrades the EGF, but it degrades the EGF receptor as well. And that means there will be less receptors on the surface of the cell and less sensitivity to signal. So by degrading both, you sort of shoot the messenger and you shoot the guy who heard the message too. You shoot them both. And this is called down-regulating receptors. It just means cutting down on the number of receptors on the surface of the cell. Now, later, the cell will make new receptors and put them onto the surface if it needs to get the signal again. So how would this work in the receptor-mediated endocytosis department? So let's go back to our handout again. So we're assuming this time the ligand matches this other receptor. And when the EGF binds to its receptor, the combination goes into a quoted pit, and the pit invaginates. Then we get a coated vesicle, and then we get an uncoated vesicle. And now this material goes from an uncoated vesicle into an endosome. Now in this case, the receptor and its ligand, the EGF, do not separate. And they go together to the half or the part of the endosome which is collecting things for degradation. So in this picture, which half would get the EGF receptor? Left or right? It's going to be the left half. The EGF receptor and the EGF are going to end up in the part of the endosome where the LDL would be, and all of this is going to be targeted for a lysosome. We've put this all in the same vesicle and in the same endosome to illustrate that a cell actually has many receptors, and it is taking in by endocytosis some combination of receptors at any one time, not just one kind. So these vesicles contain multiple receptors, and the endosome is sorting out multiple molecules. So now what happens then is the EGF and its receptor would be targeted along with LDL to a lysosome where the protein would be degraded to amino acids which can be reused. So in this case, what gets recycled? Zilch. Nothing. Everything is destroyed. Now I want to look at one more case. Questions about this one? And this case involves iron. Now, just as lipids do not float through the blood one molecule at a time, but have to go in some protected form associated with a protein, so iron does not just float through your blood either. It's attached to a protein, and the protein is called transferrin. So it looks something just diagrammatically like this. You have this big protein with iron attached to it. And The transferrin picks up the iron in the liver, goes through the blood, and then target cells trap the transferrin. So we have to add one more kind of receptor to our cell, the kind that would trap transferrin, the transferrin receptor. And it binds transferrin complex with iron. And so that receptor and its ligand are internalized. They get pinched off into a coated vesicle, into an uncoated vesicle. And now we get to the endosome. Now, in this case also, transferrin and its receptor do not separate at acid pH. But what does happen at acid pH is the iron falls off and is released to enter the cell. I'm not sure how it gets across the membrane. Perhaps there's a carrier or a channel in the membrane. But the iron is released from the complex and becomes available to the cell. So we're left with the receptor and transferrin. Now, can we use them again? Why not? Transferrin's a big protein. You don't want to junk it. You want to use it again. You want to send it back to the liver to pick up some more iron. So this time, both the receptor and transferrin go together. So which half are they going to be in if we're going to recycle them? They're going to have to be over here. So here is the transferrin receptor and its protein transferrin. But we've lost the iron. So they fit into this vesicle over here. And now this fuses with the plasma membrane. And when this vesicle fuses with the plasma membrane, maybe we should draw it over here. So when the transferrin receptor complex fuses and we open the membrane, what we're going to have now on the surface of the cell is the transferrin receptor complex. Now, what do we want to do? We want to keep the receptor on the cell, and the transferrin should go free into the blood so it can be recycled. And in fact, transferrin and its receptor don't fall apart at acid pH. They fall apart at neutral pH. So out here, outside the cell, it's neutral. And they separate. The transferrin goes into the blood to be recycled. And the transferrin receptor is back on the surface. So we have here, I think, a problem. Does transferrin stick to its receptor at neutral pH? Well, somebody said yes, and somebody said no, because I've written both on the board. Over here, the transferrin at neutral pH outside the cell stuck to its receptor, got endocytosed, etc. Over here, on the way out of exocytosis, the transferrin separates from its receptor as neutral pH. What's the difference? Iron. That one has iron, and this one doesn't. A protein without its cofactors is called APO. So this is called apotransferrin. Oops, I'll show you right here. Apotransferrin separates from the receptor at neutral pH. But iron-containing transferrin binds to its same receptor at neutral pH. So this means that the presence of the iron changes the conformation of the protein so that it's different than when it's the free form, the APO form, without iron. Now, we've talked about three examples. Two of them delivered nutrients, either the iron or the cholesterol, and one of them was a signal. There are many different cases of receptor-mediated endocytosis, and what happens in the sorting vesicle and who gets sent where depends on the ligand and the receptor that we're talking about. Now, we've considered two possibilities here, that the vesicle from the endosome can go to a lysosome and the stuff gets degraded, or the vesicle from the endosome can rejoin the plasma membrane. It can also go other places. Vesicles can go to other parts of the endomembrane system, or as we explained last time, they can actually go from one surface of the cell to the other surface of the cell. An example of that is on handout 6A from today. If you look at the bottom, we talked last time about capillaries. And last time I drew the capillaries like this. But as I said, this is not a very good picture. So I brought this picture in, the one on the bottom of 6A, to make it a little clearer what the real anatomy is. That you can see that the cells actually form a thin layer around the area of the blood vessel. The blood flows through. And that there are pores or spaces between the cells which allow small molecules to go through. Now we also have here a cross-section of a blood vessel, which looks sort of like this. These are three endothelial cells. The blood flows through the lumen in the middle, and you can see here again that there are pores through which small molecules can go. Now, small molecules like glucose will fit through the pores, but proteins will not. They are too big. And since proteins won't fit through, how are you going to get a protein across from the blood outside? For that, you have to use transcytosis, the process we talked about last time. You have endocytosis on one side of the cell, followed by exocytosis on the other. Last time, we talked about using that process to get an antibody from one side of the cell to the other. But this time, we're talking about taking a different protein from one side to the other, out of the blood, or in fact, into the blood. Now, I want to leave receptor-mediated endocytosis and talk about how you know it goes this way. But first, let me ask if there are any questions before we go on. Yeah?
With the picking of iron, exactly when does it come out? In the endosome or uncoated?
The iron is released in the endosome, not in the uncoated vesicle. So you need probably the acidity here to release the iron. Now, in all of this stuff here, in all of these processes, we've said the pink stuff goes first here, binds its receptor, and then the receptor starts, it goes to a coated pit, and the coated pit invaginates, and then it forms a coated vesicle, and then it uncoats, and so forth. How do we know that? How do we follow something into a cell and see where it goes first, where it goes next, etc.? That's what I want to talk about next, how you do labeling. First, how you follow things into a cell, and then we'll discuss how you follow newly made things out of a cell. There are two basic kinds of labeling that people use, called continuous, and then either pulse or pulse chase. And let me explain what I mean by that. Here you have a cell, and you add some labeled material outside. Let's say labeled protein. Now, this could be labeled with fluorescent dyes. It could be labeled with a lot of things, and one thing it could be labeled with is radioactive material. And we'll explain in a minute how you do it, how you find the radioactivity, because that's a very common way of doing this. So what will happen with time? If you look a little bit later, some of the radioactive stuff will have been taken up, but it won't have gone very far. And then if you wait a little bit longer, this material that already entered the cell will move somewhere else, and more radioactive material will enter. And with time, a wave of radioactive material will spread across the cell, because it will come first to wherever things go first, and then it will move on, but more radioactive material will come behind. So what will happen is gradually and eventually, probably the whole cell will become radioactive. You're watching a sort of wave. And this is a continuous label. Now, with a pulse chase label, it's a little different. You start out the same, but you only add the radioactive stuff for a little while. So you get, say, to here. A little bit's inside. And then that's the pulse part, because you only add it for a little while. The chase part is that you add non-radioactive stuff on the outside. Now, what's going to happen next? The stuff that was radioactive is going to move wherever it goes in the cell to the next spot, say over here. But now, the new stuff that moves in is not radioactive. Now, remember, if stuff isn't radioactive, you can't see it. So instead of the cell gradually getting more and more radioactive, it's going to get radioactive in one spot, and then radioactive in another spot, and then radioactive in another spot. This is a little watching a mouse go down a boa constrictor. So first the bulge is at this end, and then the bulge moves, and then the bulge moves, and then the bulge moves, and eventually there's no bulge. Well, the first one is like sending a series of mice down the boa constrictor. You put in one mouse, and then you follow it with another mouse, and another mouse, and another mouse, and another mouse. So you have this solid bulge moving down. Now, each of these has its uses. But if you do this, how do you find which part of the cell is now radioactive? There are two methods which are similar to the cases we talked about before. We talked about in situs and grind and find. One method is sort of like an in situ, and that is the technology called autoradiography. Basically, what you do is you put a photographic emulsion on top of the cell. It's like exposing this to film. And the result is that wherever there is radioactivity, there will be the emission of particles, and the film or the emulsion will become exposed and it will be developed. So you will see dark spots over where all the radioactivity is. So that's one way to find out where the radioactivity is. Put the emulsion down, let it develop, and see which parts. You count grains or spots where the film is, or the emulsion is exposed, and you say where are most of the grains, over the ER, over the Golgi, whatever. The other way you do it is like a grind and find kind of technology. You break the cells open at any particular time, and then you fractionate them by physicochemical methods, like centrifugation, into a tube with the ER pieces, a tube with the Golgi pieces, a tube with the nuclei pieces, etc. And then you test each fraction for how much radioactivity it contains. So in either of these methods, you attempt to say how much radioactivity in this part of the cell after 5 minutes, how much radioactivity in this part after 10 minutes, and so on. Now, it's using that kind of technology that we figured out that this is how receptor-mediated endocytosis goes. That's not the only way, but it's one of the major ways in which we've been able to follow it. But what I want to talk about now is sort of another variant on it. How would you follow newly made protein from the inside to the outside of the cell? If you have a cell which is secreting a lot of protein, Where is that protein made? Where does it go next? Et cetera, et cetera. How would you figure that out with a variation of this technique? Is you take cells that are secreting a lot of protein and you supply a pulse of or a continuous label of radioactive amino acids, of precursors. So you have labeled precursors such as amino acids. Now you feed this to the cells, and what are they going to do? They will use these amino acids to make new protein. So the new protein will be radioactive. But there'll also be a lot of small radioactive amino acids around. So you have to wash the cells to remove the amino acids, or whatever your precursor was, to remove the small molecules and to leave only amino acids, labeled ones, that made it into protein. So you remove the so-called unincorporated amino acids and leave only the ones that were incorporated into or added to growing chains. And now what you do is, either using autoradiography or using fractionation, you say how much radioactivity, that is, how much radioactive protein, do I find in each part of the cell? So if you look at label, that is, say, the number of grains over each section with time, suppose you do a continuous label. It means that you add radioactive amino acids, and at 5 minutes you take a sample and fix it and look at it. At 10 minutes you take another sample, fix it, and look at it. At each successive time you take a new sample and you measure how much radioactivity is in the ER. And you get something like this. This is a continuous label. Now, what does this mean? This means that you add radioactive amino acids, and more of them end up in protein in the ER. So this says that the newly made protein is in the ER. And the longer you wait, the more of it there is. But after a while, the amount in the ER plateaus. So what's happening here? What's happening here is that the stuff in the ER is moving to somewhere else, and more stuff is moving into the ER, but you've reached a balance. So the stuff moving in matches the stuff moving out, so the total amount in the ER doesn't change. But what if you look at the Golgi? If you look at the stuff in the Golgi, and I should have said this is the rough ER, not the ER. If you look at the Golgi, it looks something like this. Let me draw it right. Same shape of curve, but pushed over. Now this says radioactive material doesn't make it to the Golgi for a while. But then it builds up in the Golgi, and then you reach a stage where coming into the Golgi, going balances, going out of the Golgi, and you reach saturation. Now, in these cells that are secreting, you find many vesicles which contain the protein that's being made. They're called secretory vesicles. And if you measure the amount of radioactivity in secretory vesicles, it's here. And the one other place they measured secreted protein was secreted. That is, outside in the medium. And that goes like this. Now here, the level doesn't plateau. The level just goes up and up, because with time, more and more protein makes it out of the cell and piles up. So what does this tell us? this tells us when new protein is made, the first place you can see it is in the rough ER. This is secreted protein. And the next place you see it is in the Golgi. It takes longer for radioactivity to show up in the Golgi. And the next place you see it is in secretory vesicles. And the last place you see it is outside the cell. And this is how we get the idea that secreted protein is made on the rough ER, travels to the Golgi, goes into special vesicles, and leaves the cell. Now, this is a continuous label. What if we do a pulse chase? If you measure the radioactivity in the rough ER, it looks like this. Now that means after a short time, not much. A little later, there's a lot of radioactivity in the rough ER. Then there isn't as much, and then it falls off. So what's happening here is the radioactive material is entering the rough ER, and then it's moving on to someplace else in the cell, and the rough ER gets filled up with non-radioactive stuff. So the bulge of the boa constrictor goes through the rough ER, so to speak, and then the mouse moves on. And then the mouse goes, so to speak, from the rough ER to the Golgi. So you have to wait longer, but at a later date, the Golgi becomes radioactive, but then the material passes out of the Golgi, and then you get secretory vesicles, and then you get outside. Now, why this curve is different? Before, when you measured the radioactivity outside, it just got higher and higher and higher and higher. But that's because you did a continuous label and more stuff was flowing through. But here you're doing a pulse label, so when the boa constrictor goes out the other side, that's all there is. So the mouse, excuse me. So when the mouse gets to the end, this is the maximum amount of secreted radioactive material there is, and it has all left the cell. So these are two different ways of checking the same thing. Now, there is another kind of labeling. Questions about this? Yeah?
So do you put a pulse into many different samples and then do, for one sample, kill the thing and look where the radioactivity was after 10 seconds, the next sample, kill it after 20 seconds?
The way you would probably do this, his question is, how do you get multiple samples? Is you usually have one large sample, and you take an aliquot of it at one time, another aliquot later, another aliquot later. Because once you have taken it out, it doesn't grow anymore. You have to kill it in order to do the tests. Any more questions? Yeah. Well, continuous is easier to do, but pulse label often gives you a clearer picture. So, and also here, if it's working the way you think it is, the amount of radioactivity here should be equivalent to what's here, et cetera. So in some ways, this is a clearer and more definitive picture, but it's harder technically to do. Yeah?
Why is the radioactivity?
Well, you have a certain amount of material you supply during the pulse. And when it has been made into protein and left the cell, that's all there is. So that's why this level plateaus, because you've made all you can, and there's more coming, but it's not radioactive.
It just sits there radioactive.
What?
It just sits there outside the cell.
Well, in this circumstance, it would go, where does the material outside go? In a real cell, it would go probably into the blood or into the digestive tract or wherever it's normally sent. In these samples, if it's done in a test tube, it would sit just in the solution outside the cells. Normally, it's carried away somewhere. Okay, so there's another method that people use to follow things out besides this one, and that's using green fluorescent protein or its variants. And this method was actually invented by somebody here, by Dr. Chalfi in the bio department. a small protein made by a jellyfish that is fluorescent and green. So you could say this whole thing was invented by a jellyfish. But the use of it for biological purposes was invented by Dr. Chalker. So this is a very small protein, and by being fluorescent, we mean that if you shine light on it, it emits light. So what people do is, suppose they want to follow some protein that's going through the cell. Let's say, clathrin, that's not secreted. But suppose you want to see where clathrin is made and where it goes. Well, here's the DNA. Here's the gene for clathrin. But green fluorescent protein is a protein, and it also has a DNA sequence that codes for it. So by genetic engineering, you make a recombinant gene that has the sequence for making clathrin followed by the sequence for making GFP. So you have now a hybrid reconstructed gene with only one promoter. So you'll make a single RNA now, a single messenger RNA, and this will be translated to make a single protein. And the protein, you hope, will look something like this. This part over here is the clathrin part, and this is the green fluorescent protein part. Now, this protein will glow green when you shine light on it, so you can find out where it is. And the amazing thing is that most proteins like this work and do their normal thing. Apparently, GFP is so small that the protein can continue to function even if it has this sort of tail on the back. It doesn't seem to matter. So this protein then is made in the cell, and you can just see where it goes because it carries its own label with it. Now, there have been many variants of this now. People have fluorescent proteins that are red and blue and orange. By changing a few amino acids, you get a slightly different color. And if you look at one of the links on the web notes, one of them, somebody took a bunch of bacteria, each of which had a different fluorescent colored protein in them, and drew a picture on a petri dish, which just proves that some people have too much time on their hands. And I think we already talked about something related to this last year in the final exam, but you'll meet now many, many examples of using this to follow proteins inside cells. Now, we said that clathrin, for example, is a peripheral protein that goes and sticks to the inner side of the membrane. Secreted proteins, on the other hand, leave the cell. Now, how does a protein, so to speak, know where to go? What directs a protein to a particular part of the cell? We know that that depends on the amino acid sequence of the protein itself. Built into the protein, in its amino acid primary sequence, is the information about where to send it and how to get it there. And what we want to talk about now for the rest of the class is how that information is used and decoded and so forth. On the top of 6A, we have a basic scheme of who goes where, and then we'll talk a little bit about the mechanism, which is on the other side. Now, proteins, I said, have built into them, into their sequence, where they're supposed to go. Some proteins, the sequence that says, take me to the mitochondria or whatever, is continuous. There is a sequence of amino acids next to each other, and that is the localization signal. So this is usually called a localization sequence. If it says, take me to the nucleus, it's a nuclear localization signal. If it says, take me to the peroxisome, it's a peroxisomal localization signal. Or, more correctly, sequence. It's a signal which is a sequence. In some proteins, it's not the amino acids in the primary sequence order, but the protein, the amino acids in the three-dimensional shape that determine where it goes. The signal, the localization signal, consists, say, of this part, which if you stretched it out would be two parts of the protein in the chain. But when you fold it up in three dimensions, these sections form a contiguous patch. So this is called a localization patch. So a protein has one or more patches or sequences which direct it to where it's supposed to go. So how are these read? The cell starts making a protein. A ribosome attaches to a message, and you start making a protein. And it's what's in this protein itself that's going to determine the next stage. There is a sequence here, which is usually called a signal sequence, or a signal peptide. And if it's present, then this ribosome will attach to the ER and become part of the rough ER. So there are two possibilities. No signal sequence. Then the ribosome remains free in the cytoplasm, not attached to any membranes. And it continues to make its protein. Now, the ribosome is attached to message, but it's not attached to any membranes or organelles. And so you have here a free ribosome, free in the cytoplasm, and it makes protein in the cytoplasm. Now, what is going to become of that protein depends on what signals, other signals, or sequences, or patches it has. If there is no other sequence of any kind, or tag, or patch, there's no more information, then the protein stays in the cytoplasm. The default, so to speak, is just to stay. But if the protein has the proper localization signal, then it can be sent into an organelle. The protein's already been made, but it can wiggle into the organelle. And this is called post-translational transport or import. So this is, you make the protein first, and then it wiggles into, as shown here, either mitochondria or chloroplasts, nuclei, or peroxisomes. Now notice these are not part of the endomembrane system. And they get their protein from free ribosomes that made their protein in the cytoplasm. Mitochondria and chloroplasts do make a few of their own proteins, but most of their proteins are made in the cytoplasm and then imported into the organelle. And this is not a trivial matter because mitochondria have two membranes and chloroplasts have three. So you have to get to the right part of the organelle, which turns out to be complicated. To get into the nucleus, you need what's so-called nuclear localization signal. To get into a peroxisome, you need a peroxisomal localization signal. And we'll talk later more about how those work. So this is the stuff that is not part of the endomembrane system. What about that part? If the protein has a signal sequence or a signal peptide, then this ribosome will attach to the surface of the ER. And when the protein is made, the protein will wiggle into the ER. So the protein is in the ER. So let's draw a little piece of ER. And see what we're talking about. The ER is a bunch of membrane-bound tubes and vesicles. Hearsay is a piece of the art. So the lumen is inside here, the space inside the ER, and there's a membrane surrounding it, and we've made a cross-section. So if this is the membrane, as the protein is being made, it is inserted across the membrane into the ER. So this is called co-translational import. Because what's happening here is the protein is entering the ER as it's being made, not afterwards. Now, in yeast, a few of the proteins are made in the cytoplasm, some of them, and go into the ER. But in animal cells, most of the proteins that are going to end up in the ER are made in the ER, and the proteins, there is very little post-translational transport into the ER. Now, what can happen if the protein does this? If the protein goes all the way through, it will end up in the lumen of the ER. So one possibility is that it will end up in the lumen. But another possibility is the protein won't wiggle all the way through, and the protein will get stuck in the membrane, and then you have a transmembrane protein. Now, we'll talk next time in more detail about how this happens. This by itself is sort of sufficient to explain a single-pass protein, but how would a multiple-pass protein do it? And we'll get to that next time, but we're not going to talk about it today. Well, once the protein is either in the membrane or in the lumen of the ER, some proteins stay there. They function in the ER, and they stay there. But even most proteins that function in the ER move on to the next stage. Most proteins of the ER are made, go through the ER, go through the Golgi, and then are sent back to the ER. So most of these then go to the next stage, which is the Golgi. So suppose you have a protein like this or a protein like this. How are you going to get it to the Golgi? The way it happens is that the membrane of the ER, the membrane of the ER buds off, and you form a vesicle containing the contents of the ER, and then this vesicle goes and fuses with the Golgi. So suppose you have a transmembrane protein, and say, we'll call this end X. When you make a vesicle, where is X? Is it on the inside of the vesicle or the outside of the vesicle? And when the vesicle fuses with the Golgi, where will X be? Will it be on this side or in the lumen of the Golgi? And I want you to try that. Maybe draw it on a piece of paper and see what you think, and discuss it maybe with the person next to you. Where does this domain, which is now in the lumen of the ER, where does it end up when you make a vesicle and fuse with the Golgi? Is it in the lumens? Is it outside? Where does it end up? This is the deadest class tonight. It's been a long day. So let's try this. When this vesicle fuses, where is the pink part of the transmembrane protein? Is it outside or inside? It's inside because, let's try it, it would be here. And then when the vesicle pinches off, it's like this. But now, when this fuses with the Golgi, what's going to happen? Where is this going to end, the pink going to end up? Is it going to end up inside the Golgi or sticking out in the cytoplasm? How many people think it's going to end up sticking out in the cytoplasm? Inside the lumen. Undecided. Chicken. Okay. Now, how does this work? Everybody says that what's going to happen is it's going to end up, the pink part's going to end up in the lumen. And that's going to happen because this is what the vesicle looks like, this is what the Golgi looks like, and when the two of them fuse, the material here is inside. Now, you notice the point of this, that what is on the cytoplasmic side always stays on the cytoplasmic side. And when this vesicle fuses, if we get a vesicle out the other end, and it fuses with the plasma membrane, where is the pink going to be this time? If this is the plasma membrane and the two of them fuse, it's going to be outside the cell. And so we're going to get this, essentially, which when I open it up, the stuff that used to be in the lumen is going to be sticking out of the cell. But the other way to look at it is that what's in the cytoplasm is always in the cytoplasm. And what's in the lumens is always in the lumen. But I want to ask you to think about this one more time. We've been drawing each membrane as if it's a single line. But of course, it isn't. Each membrane is a bilayer. So how do you keep the P and the E parts of the bilayer in the correct orientation? It's perhaps easiest to see if I draw this one. So if this is a bilayer, and maybe it would be better to draw it this way, here's a vesicle with a bilayer. So this is the P side of the bilayer, and this is the E side. Now, when it fuses with the plasma membrane, what does it look like? This is the P side. Yeah, I drew it the wrong way. This is the E side, and this is the P. When I fuse the two of them, how is it going to come out right? Because the pink here is on this side, and the pink there is on that side. And yet we know that what's on the cytoplasm is always on the cytoplasmic side. So let's see how that works. What's going to happen is we're going to break both of them. So it's going to look like It's going to look like this. And now you see how it could work, because you're going to fuse this membrane, this monolayer this way, and this one that way, this one this way, and this one this way. So that's how we're always going to keep the E on the E side and the P on the P side, even with a bilayer. And it's worth trying this when you get home to be sure you see how it goes. Okay. So we got our protein, we got our stuff to the Golgi. If we have a vesicle butting off the ER, it can carry two things to the Golgi. It can carry the transmembrane protein, but it also can carry the soluble protein that was inside the lumen. And both of these can end up in the Golgi, and both of these can be carried to the plasma membrane. So let's go back to our flow chart again and see what happens next. Once stuff gets to the Golgi, vesicles bud off the far side of the Golgi, which is called the trans side, or the trans-Golgi network. And those vesicles now that come out of the Golgi contain both membrane proteins and what people call cargo proteins completely inside, soluble proteins inside the lumen of the vesicle. So where are these things going to go? One possibility is they're simply going to fuse with the plasma membrane, which means that anything that was inside will be delivered to the outside of the cell. That's what would happen to a secreted protein. It would be inside the lumen and spit out. And a transmembrane protein would remain on the cell surface. Now, those vesicles that come off the Golgi in a cell that's doing a lot of secretion are what we've called before the secretory vesicles. Now, there are actually two similar kinds of vesicles that cells make: secretory vesicles and default vesicles. Now, both of them contain membrane, transmembrane proteins and cargo inside. But the difference is the default vesicles fuse with the plasma membrane automatically. And they deliver either transmembrane proteins to the membrane or cargo to the outside. Secretory vesicles only fuse with the membrane when the cell receives a signal. So they sit around and wait, containing a package of stuff. And when they get the signal, they fuse with the plasma membrane and spit out the stuff. So people also refer to this as regulated and unregulated secretion. Regulated meaning you need a signal to release to have fusion. Unregulated or constitutive meaning that you don't. So this also goes to the plasma membrane. And in both of these cases, things can either go to the surface of the cell or be released. But here we need a signal, and for default vesicles, you don't. Now, where else could these vesicles go? We haven't really discussed it, but what goes on in the Golgi is processing, and at the end of the Golgi is basically sorting. Vesicles bud off from different parts of the Golgi, much like different parts of an endosome, and some of them go to the plasma membrane. Where do the others go? Some of these either form lysosomes or join new lysosomes. Those that contain hydrolytic enzymes are destined for lysosomes. So that's one of the possibilities here. We've drawn lysosomes. And the other possibility is just other parts of the endomembrane system. We mentioned earlier that some vesicles carrying stuff out the end of the Golgi carry their stuff back to the ER or an early part of the Golgi or someplace else. So these vesicles can go to the plasma membrane or some organelle which is part of the endomembrane system. Now, this is a picture of how of what the sort of instructions are, but it doesn't say anything about mechanism. Yes?
Do all the proteins that end up on the surface cell membrane, are they all transmembrane, or have peripheral ones get there?
Okay, where do peripheral proteins come from? Peripheral proteins on the inside have to be made in the cytoplasm, because they're not part of the membrane. Peripheral proteins on the outside have to be made here in order to be secreted. So the extracellular matrix is made this way and then secreted, probably by these. Now, we haven't said anything of mechanism, and I want to talk for the last few minutes a little bit about the mechanism on the other side of your handout on 6B. We're just going to talk about the beginning. We said here that if a protein has this special little sequence, the signal sequence or signal peptide, it will be directed to the ER and the protein will end up in the endomembrane system. But if that section is missing, the ribosome just sits there and keeps on chugging out protein. Now, this implies that the signal sequence has some sort of affinity for the ER. And that if you make this protein, it will stick to the ER and enter the ER. Well, that's what people thought at first, but it's not true. It turns out this protein sequence does not stick to the ER at all. Instead, you need a middleman. And that middleman is called the SRP. The signal peptide sticks to the SRP, and the SRP sticks to the ER. Now, when this was first discovered, people thought it was a protein, and they thought that the signal peptide stuck to the special protein and the protein stuck to the ER. So this is called the signal recognition protein. But we now realize that this is not a single protein. This is a complex particle containing both RNA and protein. So this is like a ribosome or a spliceosome. It is a complicated machine. And so now it's called the signal recognition particle. So the signal peptide or sequence binds to the signal recognition particle, and the signal recognition particle binds to the ER. And that allows the ribosome to get attached to the ER and have its protein wiggle into the ER as it is made. And this handout has all the steps in it. And what we'll do is we'll stop here. And next time, you should bring back this handout, and we'll go through the steps on this handout.